Pleasure. I've judged with you twice. I don't know if you remember, but once in the one show. But you had a very different look about you then.
Oh, that must have been a while ago.
It was 2004.
Trying to remember. Well, nice to talk to you again.
Yeah. Likewise. It was I remember Bob Barry was on it at the time, but he didn't seem very chatty. Because I thought, God, the famous Bob Barry, but he didn't seem to want to chat.
I remember that. That's God. Where was that? Where were we?
That was.
I remember. I wasn't supposed to judge, and someone dropped out, and then I came in, and I don't know. Bob Barry was weird that year because I met him after that, and he was much nicer.
Oh, really? Well, I used to love Fallon stuff, and I was really excited to meet him and chat and hang out, and literally nothing, zip, but it was good.
That's so weird you say that, because
I picked up that vibe.
Yeah, because I loved Fallon, too, and I loved your Tom Elliott piece.
Oh, have you heard that?
Yeah. Oh, good.
When
I first got into advertising, like, he was one of the writers that I actually blatantly copied. But then I was really excited to meet Bob Barry, and I remember going up to him when we were judging, and saying, like, "Hi, I'm Jerry Graff," and he looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, I know who you are," and then he walked away, and I was like,
"God, that's strange."
Yeah,
I think I got similarly short shrift, as we say over here. But I can't remember whether I was like, "Hi, I'm Dave Dye," but I do remember getting a very frosty reception. So I'm glad it's not just me.
Yeah, maybe he was going something.
It's funny, all guys with alliterative names as well. You'd think we'd all kind of hang out and get on. It's
right.
Weird.
Yeah, you know.
Right, let's go. Are we ready? All the levels okay? We're all good. The levels feel great to me. How are the levels feeling on that side of the pond?
Well, if my levels, you know, can I hear you? I can hear you.
Yep.
So. As long as you
guys can hear Jerry's giving. Okay, Jerry's thumbs up the levels. So first off, Jerry, I have to thank you for taking time to do this. And the first question has come in due to me bumping into Paul Silbern on the way in, which is Arsene Wenger. Should he stay? Should he go?
Go.
Go?
Yeah.
God, that's a very controversial start. But weirdly, why the hell do you support Arsenal? I mean, I'm an Arsenal supporter. I'm an Arsenal season ticket holder. I'm just surprised where you live.
It's not a great reason. It's not a great reason, but it's an interesting reason. So, my oldest daughter is 17, so this was 11 years ago. So she was 6 years old.
Right.
And, my wife signed me up to coach, the local New York, girls soccer. And so I was coaching my daughter and a bunch of 6-year-old girls, and I was doing this reading on why players in the United States aren't as good as the rest of the world. And I saw something interesting that, like, if you go down to, like, the New York City basketball courts, you'll see young kids, like, trying to do moves like Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, because they watch them on TV all the time and they try to copy them. And people in young athletes don't watch soccer. So I decided, you know, we're going to watch soccer every Saturday. And Fox, there's a Fox soccer network here. And they were airing the Premier League, you know, live at like 10 o'clock in the morning. So I decided my daughter and I were going to watch some soccer together every Saturday. And we needed to pick a team. So the first one that came to mind, and I didn't really know that much about the Premier League. The first one that came to mind was Manchester United, obviously, right? You know, 11, 12 years ago. And I'm like, nah, you can't do that. That's like everybody loving the New York Yankees at the time. just because they're good.
Too easy.
So too easy. So I showed my daughter the list of teams, and I said, pick one that we're going to root for. And she, I guess she just looked at the top of the alphabetical list and said, she goes, I like the name Arsenal. I said, okay, we're going to find out everything about Arsenal, and we're going to start following Arsenal. So that's how it started.
Okay.
12 years ago.
Well, you lucked out.
And, yeah, we did all right.
Yeah, I think you must have started following just when they started to fall off. Before that, they were winning everything. But
it was. But I liked it. It wasn't a bandwagon choice, but it wasn't a bad choice.
No, it was a good choice. It would change.
We would have been really cool if we started following Manchester City, right?
Yeah.
12 years ago.
Just before they took off. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually it worked. She's a really good player.
Cool. Right, so as we go through this, Jerry, I've tried to do as much research as I can. Some areas of your career, like when you played Tum Tum Tugger in the 1985 Lexington High School production, I can find tons of reviews. Certain areas, where you're at Cole and Weber, I can't.
I made that Rum Tum Tugger up.
You're kidding.
I promise.
There's a ton of reviews on...
No, I know.
Well, ironically, I
promise you, I will not make anything up this time. But every once in a while, I like to just play with the press, and I just went online and I found a picture of someone who looked vaguely.
No, you're kidding. This is fake news.
Yeah.
Fake news.
Totally fake.
You New Yorkers.
Totally fake.
Fake news. Okay, so first off, where did you grow up, Jerry?
I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, which is a few miles outside of Boston. So it's where the first Battle of the Revolutionary War was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Has that fed into any of your work?
That kind of area? I think it has a little... I have a lot of problems with authority, and... I think that part of coming from the town that basically started this country, I think it rubbed off on me. I'm not kidding either. I think I
really?
Grew up with that attitude. Yeah.
So one of the things that I've found is your first writing gig, hopefully this is not a lie that you've put out in the media, was for Notre Dame's Keenan Review.
Yes.
I have no idea what any of those words mean. What was that?
All right. Well, Notre Dame is the biggest Catholic university in the States. And I went there because my dad went there. I didn't really have a choice. And I was actually studying pre-med. And I just happened to be in the dorm that put on this campus-wide comedy review. I didn't know it at the time. I didn't choose it. I was not a writer. I did not think myself creative at all. And I just hung out with guys who wrote for this comedy review. And I would just start like suggesting ideas for skits or jokes that they would perform. And it came rather easy. It's not that hard to make fun of Catholics.
Sure. And what would have been your comedy influences at that time?
Monty Python was huge for me. I think Boston, Massachusetts might have been the first or second place where their show started airing in the States in like the in the mid 70s. We had a public. It's called PBS, Public Broadcasting System. And, in Boston, you have a lot of colleges, Harvard and MIT and all that. And our public station was really, ahead of most other places. And I started seeing Monty Python there, and I just thought it was the greatest, crazy stuff in the world. But I actually find a lot of copywriters my age, Monty Python was a major influence.
I know, it seems so strange because it's the most English of programs. You know, all the references are fantastically English. They couldn't be more English, those guys. I mean, I love Monty Python too, but I'm surprised how many Americans love that. I guess it's just so exotic compared to your what's there.
Yeah, It was exotic. It was.
Is it the absurdity?
Absurd.
Of it?
Yeah. It was absurd, but at the same time, you know, they went to Cambridge and Oxford, so behind it all, there was it was really smart. You could tell even when Palin is doing the fish slapping dance with John Cleese. I don't know.
Yep.
It's the most ridiculous thing in the world, but it there seemed to be some intelligence behind it. And then I remember seeing Holy Grail for the first time. You know, I was watching the show mid-70s as 10, 11 years old. So
what about the American comics like Woody Allen, Albert Brooks, any of those guys, or just?
Yeah, my wife kind of got me into Woody Allen, and but before that, I would say Mel Brooks, Blazing Saddles, I remember my dad taking me to see Young Frankenstein, and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world.
Yeah,
he was huge with me, and then I loved all the Warner Brothers cartoons,
the Looney Tunes.
The Looney Tunes, Bugs, the really early ones that, I think Chuck Jones,
yeah.
When Daffy Duck was an asshole, I adored. And I loved Tom and Jerry. I was huge on cartoons. And I liked Tom and Jerry because of most other Saturday morning cartoons, they were G-rated, and there was always a moral to the story. But in Tom and Jerry, I liked the fact that Tom the cat very often really got to kick the crap out of Jerry the mouse. I mean, just like flatten him with a frying pan and stuff like that. I never liked the Roadrunner. I always wanted that bird to really,
get
smashed
it.
By a boulder. Yeah. And he never did. But in Tom and Jerry, I just loved it when Tom won sometimes.
Just gratuitous violence, no morals.
Exactly, yeah.
So once you got into kind of writing comedy in that review, did you not consider taking that on? Because I think your next job, you became a stockbroker from there.
I did. I never considered it. I never thought I could make a living doing it. It was just something I really enjoyed. And when I graduated, I actually moved to Hollywood right after graduation. Not with any ideas of making it as a writer. I just wanted to. I'd never been to Hollywood, and I worked as an exterminator for a friend of mine's brother.
You moved to Hollywood to become an exterminator?
I did. I lived in Venice. It just sounded great. My friend said, "Hey, you want to move to Venice Beach, California? And we have jobs there.
Kill some stuff.
My brother's garage." And that actually, being an exterminator, came back 20 years ago and helped me win an account. So it paid off. But I just went out there. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And my dad was like, "You have to get a real job." And I kind of discovered writing, and writing wasn't really a real job. And so I moved back to Boston and got a job. Yeah, as a stockbroker, I got my broker's license, and I did that for 2 years, I guess. And I was miserable. I had to wear these, double-breasted suits and the whole gig, and I hated it. I think I was the only stockbroker in the 80s who lost money.
Oh, really?
I was horrible. I would apologize. I would make cold calls and apologize to people for bothering them. And your bosses would listen to your cold calls on the line, and my boss would yell at me. And I remember one of them telling me I had to be a shark. You have to be a shark.
Jesus. Very Wall Street. Was that the era of the Wall Street film? Were you watching that thinking this is kind of where
I want
to be?
Yeah, that's when, Wall Street and Gordon Gekko.
Yeah.
And,
was it that period, exact period you were there?
It was 1988, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's basically it. And I did not like Gordon Gekko, and I didn't like Charlie Sheen's character. I remember being told to be a shark and thinking in my mind that I was more of a monkey.
Mm. I don't think.
And then I would work in Boston. My girlfriend, who's my wife now, worked in Boston. I got out a little earlier, and I was sitting in some park in Boston and thinking, I'm too young to hate my job, and I want to do something that I really like. And I was having a conversation with myself, and I'm like, I want to wake up in the morning and do something that I love to do. Even if at the start there's no money in it, if I wake up every morning wanting to do it, then yeah. I'm gonna get really good at it. Even if it's like, you know, I don't know, making anything, right? I'll be the best chair maker in the world.
Sure.
Every morning I wake up and I want to make chairs. So then I asked myself, what do you love to do? And I loved writing for that review. I loved staying up till 5 in the morning trying to write skits and stuff like that. And then I'm like, okay, we'll try to find a job where I can write. And then I actually moved back to Los Angeles and gave it a bit of a try to break into TV writing, and that was a disaster. But I had a friend, and I didn't even know what advertising was. All I knew about advertising was from like Bewitched or
Was the husband in Bewitched was in advertising, was he?
Yeah, he was in advertising. It was a sitcom, and then there was also a show on at the time called 30 Something.
Yeah, I remember that. That made advertising seem cool. They used to play with that. I remember they used to have a hoop in their office that they'd throw the waste paper in.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And I thought, I want an office like that.
Yeah, I want to do that. And then like, there was a movie called Nothing in Common with Tom Hanks and Jackie Gleason.
I haven't seen that.
And Tom Hanks was a creative director. And I'm like, wow, that looks really cool. And then I had a good friend who went to Boston University, which is a great communications college. And a lot of advertising people came out of there, and she explained to me what advertising was and what Adweek and AdAge was. And I started looking into it, and then, you know, about, I guess I must have been 24 at the time. And it looked really cool, and it looked much easier writing a headline than an entire, you know, 110-page script.
Sure.
So when I was living in L.A., I'd get up at 5 in the morning, you know, because of the time change, because the New York Stock Exchange opens up at, what is it, 9 or 9:30. And do my job there, get out at 2 o'clock, and I took a class at night, a copywriting class. And I still remember the ad. In the magazine Adweek, there used to be classifieds in the back. And I remember the ad saying, if you can't write, call.
Oh, I remember that,
Yeah, Steve Gary's copywriting workshop.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And I thought that line alone was just wonderful. So I took that for 3 months. I actually still have my portfolio from that class, and it's horrible. I don't know why I got a job, but so that's kind of like, you know,
so,
about 24, 25 I started.
So were there any ads around at the time that were inspiring you? You thinking this is part of a gang I want to belong to? You know, what would have been the ads that you admired around that time?
Yeah, it was the original Cliff Freeman Little Caesar stuff.
Yeah,
that I loved. You know, I still remember the ad my friend and I loved, which was guy walks in and says, "Do I get?" He goes to a competitor. Do I get 2 large pizzas for 1 low price? And the guy says, "No, here you get a pizza in a box." And the customer says, what do I do with a box? And the guy behind the counter says, ever hear of origami? And he takes the box and he makes it into a pterodactyl. And he starts screaming,
Funny.
That must have been like 88 or 89, I think. And I was like, I just loved that.
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, and then I you know, started doing a lot of research and stuff. And I got the movie on Ogilvy on advertising book,
right? Yeah.
And he suggested for writers to just pick ads that you like and try to write like that, and eventually you'll develop your own style. So, and then go buy some annuals and find out what good advertising is, and I did that. So, and then I was in L.A., you know, trying to get a job. I was the only person in Los Angeles with a bicycle, so I would drive around with my portfolio, you know, and sweating and, you know, being late to interviews and stuff, and nobody would hire me. It was about a year of trying to get into advertising in Los Angeles, and then I was really, really bad and very, very shy, and For whatever reason, I really wanted to do it. So I would go in and people would rip my book apart and tell me it was horrible. And, you know, it was not in my character, but for whatever reason, I said, can you be more specific? Exactly why are my ads horrible? Because I figured if I knew what I was doing wrong, I could change it. And so I brought on, I said, you know, just let me have it. And then I found there was this one guy, Ken Fitzgerald, in like 1989 at Lord Dentsu in Los Angeles. And I had one ad and one headline that he liked. I don't even remember what the headline was, but he decided to help me. And he's like, keep taking classes, keep calling me up. You know, I have my own job, so I'm not going to call you back right away, but don't stop calling me. And I would work on my book and stuff like that. And I think after like 7 or 8 months, I finally got good enough. So he showed me, he introduced me to his boss, Lee Covell, who hated my book, but for whatever reason said, I know somebody in New York who has like a, you know, it wasn't an intern program, but it was kind of like a junior creative program. And it was at Saatchi & Saatchi. And he put me in touch with this woman, Marie Arteca. And she's like, well, if you're ever in New York, give me a call. And like TWA Airlines had this $120 round trip ticket to New York sale. And my wife and I flew to New York City. I had never been to New York City before. And I still remember when I got my first job. It was a very kind of New York moment. I had two portfolios, and I went to Backer Spiel Vogel Bates because they were doing the Miller Lite stuff at the time, which I liked. And I went to Saatchi & Saatchi, and then I had another interview, I think it's Scally McCabe, and I needed my portfolio back. And I was in Grand Central Station. And I used the payphone to call Saatchi & Saatchi and say I needed my portfolio back because I only had two and I had a third interview. And they said, we're not giving you your portfolio back. And I was mad. And I said, because we're hiring you.
Wow.
And I felt my memory of that moment, I still go into Grand Central Station. The payphones are gone, but I know exactly where it was when I got that job. And I did it. In my memory, it was like, I don't know if you know the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she throws her hat up in the air.
That's what I felt.
You threw your cap up in the air.
I threw something up in the air, and just it was the greatest day of my life.
And was that basically with the book that Lee Covell had trashed?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing.
He was talking about like gestalt and synergy, and I was like, "What the hell is this guy talking about?" And I was like, you know, I guess my headlines were good, but it just had an image that you didn't even need the image on the printout to make the headline make sense. And he was trying to explain to me that the whole thing has to work together. But for whatever reason, I guess I was a good enough junior writer that he passed me along. But it was that guy, Ken Fitzgerald, the creative director, who just went out of his way to help me.
Do you think he spotted something, or he spotted desperation and then just kind of reached out and tried to help you?
Well, he spotted out of 12 ads, he spotted one headline, and I remember him pointing at it. He goes, "Do this. This is it." So he saw something in me that I could do it at least one out of 12 times, right?
Yeah.
And I think he really just recognized that I really wanted it. And I've come to learn that, you know, that passion, you know, is as important as talent, I think. And from that day when I, you know, ever since when I, you know, when I became creative director and moved on, when I've done my best to try to tell people who, you know, have a little bit of talent and are really, really hungry.
Hmm.
And then get this. This is weird. I'm not. I mean, tell me if I'm talking too much.
No, this is exactly what we're here for.
Yeah. So get this. So he helps me out, and I call him up, and then let's see. 17 years later, Maybe 15 years later, like 2004 or 5, my father-in-law passes away. And I'm in Boston, and we're at my wife's, you know, family house, and sitting Shiva. She's Jewish, and we're there. And my wife's older sister was working at a direct marketing company in Boston called Bronner, which later turned into Digitas.
Right.
And she's like, oh, she was an account person. She's like, my creative director is going to stop by here. And it's Ken Fitzgerald in Boston 15 years later. And I she didn't tell me what his name was. I just saw him, and I'm like, oh my God. And I just went up to him and hugged him. And by that time, I had a decent career going and stuff.
Amazing. He'd come to see you, or it was by chance
It was by chance. Oh, wow. He worked on American Express direct with my sister-in-law, who was an account person. He was just coming, you know, to give her comfort, you know, to just pay her his respects. And we were just at my father-in-law's funeral together after 15 years after me, you know, I'm standing there with a guy who pretty much changed my life, you know, and let me, you know, go into the profession, you know, pretty much helped me get my dream job, right?
And had he followed your career, Jerry? Did he know what you were up to or what you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, from that one ad, you know, and he had known, you know, I had since then I had done, you know,
good stuff.
Work that had got press, you know, some Snickers stuff and FedEx stuff and E-Trade, and he knew exactly who I, you know, from just reading the trade, he knew I was kid, that desperate kid, you know, with all the horrible puns.
Cool.
Yeah.
So what was Saatchi's like in the, what was that, the late 80s?
So this is like this, Saatchi was around 90, I guess, okay. 90 or 91, and probably 91. You remember that moment in Grand Central where I threw my hat in the
air? Yeah.
After about 3 months at working at Saatchi, writing radio scripts for a diet pill called Dexatrim, yes, basically speed.
Yeah.
I think it's illegal now. And their spokesperson was a soap opera star. Her name was Deirdre Hall. And like every radio script had to start, you know, hi, I'm Deirdre Hall from Days of Our Lives. Independent studies show that Dexatrim, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
I remember like just going from the high of Grand Central Station to 3 months at doing that going, wait a sec, this is not what Tom Hanks was doing in Nothing in Common. This is not what I thought it was going to be. It was not fun. So I really started working on my portfolio and doing my own ads. It was rough.
Was there anyone good there who helped you or you looked up to?
There was this one. Like group creative director, her first name was Diane, and I don't remember her last name, but I remember going in and showing work. You know how like you put your portfolio together, you try to do just the most awesome work you can,
and then you get
into a real agency, and I guess I adjusted my writing to what I thought Saatchi would want, and it was very straightforward, boring stuff. So I was doing that, and my partner and I went in and showed her some work, and she started yelling at us. She's like, "We didn't hire you to do this." She's like, "I got 20 people who can do this." She's like, "You gotta work all night, write ads." She's like, "Drink a bottle of Jack Daniels or something, and then come in here with stuff that I'm going to tell you there's no way in the world we could sell."
Cool.
And yelled at us. And that was fantastic, you know. So then we tried that, and we just ended up not selling anything. That kind of got a little annoying. But I remember, you know, getting you know, basically slapped in the face by my creative director telling me, you know, stop being a hack. The industry's full of hacks trying to do something new. So that pushed me a little bit. So I just worked on my – and the other thing is at Saatchi & Saatchi, Cliff Freeman was in the building. So Cliff Freeman was on the 8th floor, and I was up on the 16th floor. And, you know, before I was even in advertising, I loved their ads. And I remember going up in the elevator in the people getting out on the 8th floor, and they just – it just looked like, I don't know, just this like – the greatest place in the world, and then the elevator doors would close, and I couldn't get out to Cliff Freeman. So for about a year, I was just like working on my portfolio. I think I sent it down to Cliff Freeman maybe 4 times in a year.
You sent your portfolio down?
Yeah.
Did you not try your usual, just tell me what's wrong with these ads, what can I do? You didn't try getting in there or getting any personal...
No, I did, but I guess my book was so bad that they wouldn't even let me meet with anybody. They would I mean you remember trying to get a job, and I would go down there and I would drop my book off, and they would show it to whoever the creative recruiter was, and then you'd get the call, and they would just say, come pick up your book.
It's ready.
It's like the it's like the walk of shame. Remember that?
It was, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's so painful to just go down there and. And you're not even allowed into the place. You can just kind of take 2 steps into the lobby, and they kind of give you your portfolio. And the receptionist, you know, is looking at you. From my view, it's just like, oh, you poor, pathetic loser.
Yeah, it's as if she's shaking her head.
Here's this. I remember she wouldn't even get it. I remember she'd go, it's in the closet. And I'm like, oh, it was so painful.
Didn't want to handle it.
Yeah, it's in there.
It's in there. I don't want to touch it.
You know, those days are gone. I don't know. Maybe it would be healthy if we could shame bad creative directors now with their link. You know, you sent me your link, but I didn't even leave it in my email. It's in the closet email. Go in there and get that link. You know, it just made me work harder. And I remember actually discovering Tom McElliott, and I just started ripping him off. I started writing spec ads for a monastery in Queens, with headlines like "Any closer to God and you'd be dead." Going through the annuals, you know, the one show, the DNAD, and I got out of Saatchi in about a year.
That sounds like purgatory to be. In somewhere where you're having to write ads for, what was it called, Dexatrin. The woman from Best Days of Your Life, and then a few floors below, you've got one of the best agencies in the world, literally beneath your feet.
Yes, not only the best agency, but they had made the ads that made me
that
love
loved.
Advertising.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, it was horrible. But it was, you know, I'm a better person now for going through it, I think.
So how
better
did you get...
I know that.
How did you get out there, Saatchi's?
I just started making spec work and you know, for working with like headhunters, and there was another agency, Wells Rich Green.
Mary Wells. It was great at one point.
It was, but she wasn't there anymore. But I didn't know that. I just wanted to get. Yeah, I just needed one step. You know, I didn't have to go from Saatchi to Cliff Freeman, and I just needed what I thought was at least one step up. And you know, I sent my portfolio over there, and there was this young creative director, young at the time, I guess 35 or something like that. His name's Michael Mark, and he's still a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
He called me up, and it was actually those monastery ads. The headlines for them. He's like, I love these, you know. And he called me in and hired me as a junior writer. But that was a strange situation because it was not like the Braniff, Mary Wells place. So they were on their way down too. And when I got to Wells Rich Green, within 3 months they lost IBM, MCI phones. I think MCI turned into Verizon. I think that's, anyways, another huge phone like client. So they lost IBM, MCI, and Continental Airlines, just three major accounts in, for my first 6 months. And I remember, you know, back in those days, like everybody had an office. So I was like, I was in an office with like three guys, and we just stayed in the office and shut our door. We figured if they didn't see us, they wouldn't fire us.
Did that work?
You know? Yeah, they didn't fire me, but I was making, I don't know, what, 30 grand a year. So it wouldn't have paid to ax me, you know, and, you know. So I stayed there for about, a year and a half, I think, maybe 2 years.
Was Charlie Moss there at that time?
Yeah,
was
Charlie
he?
Moss was there, and he...
he was one of the legendary figures who had done all of the early great stuff that they used to do.
That's what they told me.
What was
That's what they told me. He actually, I had a partner who was had a bit of a mouth, and we went up with our creative director Michael Mark and presented some work to Charlie. And then after about an hour later, Michael came in and said, "Charlie never wants to see you guys in his office again."
Wow. Yeah. So did you produce anything good that ran there? Did anything come out?
Did I sell anything?
Yeah, that you liked.
Yeah, I did these small space newspaper ads for Liberty Mutual Insurance. That I got made, and I was really proud of it. So this is 93 or 94 when Clinton was president,
yeah.
And Hillary Clinton, the first lady at the time, she was put in charge of overhauling insurance in 93 and 94. And I remember one of my headlines was for Liberty Mutual Insurance: lower rates for more coverage. How hard was that, Mrs. Clinton?
Cool.
So, yeah, so I like that. So, but and then I did something. I did my first TV spot was I think for the National MS Society, Multiple Sclerosis.
Yeah.
You know, and I worked with Michael Mark and his partner Patrick Flaherty on that. Then I got then my old part. Not even my partner, but at Saatchi, there was an art director who was next to me. He had gone from Saatchi to BBDO. So mid-90s, BBDO is just like the hottest place in the world.
Mm.
And we were friends. We never worked together at Saatchi, I don't think, but we were friends. And he said that there was a creative director at BBDO looking, and I remember this, he's like, he's looking for a headline writer. Not even a copy.
That's how they described it.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, a headline writer, and I was good at headlines. You know, like I said,
copying Tom McElligott for 6 years.
Tom McElligott, yeah. And I was also a huge fan of Mark Fenske. He was at Wyden at the time, and I was trying to write like them, and that's pretty good. So, about 2 years, I guess, at Wellsridge Green, I just sent all my headlines to this guy named Jimmy Siegel, and I got a job over at BBDO. And that's kind of when things kind of taken off for me.
So were you never at Cole and Weber?
No, never.
No. So when I was tracking down your work, an ad came up with your name on it, Cole and Weber. It was a picture of an oyster, and it was said like this town, and then the pearl said the so-and-so center. Does that ring a bell? Have they just miscredited you on that?
They miscredited me. I know that ad, too. It's weird that I got...
double check that.
Because at that time, I loved Cole and Weber. So,
yeah. Kind of weird. I'll double check that. So you managed to get into BBDO, and who was the creative director who was looking?
Ted San was the head guy. And then Charlie Miesmer was the ECD, and then the creative director was Jimmy Siegel, and he hired me. And and that was BBDO was a bit of an adventure. I don't know where I kind of copped an attitude because I really wasn't that good, but I kind of did, and Jimmy Siegel. I worked for him for a while, and he kind of kicked me out of his group. So we have a trend going here.
Right.
And Susan Cradle. Do you know Susan?
No, I don't know.
She's like global CCO of FCB right now, I think.
Right.
And before that, she was Leo Burnett, North American Chief Creative Officer. And she was creative director of BBDO for a long time. And she was actually really good at BBDO, maybe because she was like the only woman creative director at BBDO. You know, it was like a real frat house back then. And I don't know, she saw something in me and she started giving me assignments on M&Ms. And, you know, I owe her a lot, you know, for just like I was floating, you know, because I was no longer in Jimmy Siegel's group. I was just floating around as a writer. And she gave me some assignments on M&Ms. And she kicked me out of her group, too.
Did she? So why was this? Why were you becoming a problem child? You were just had a clear idea of what you liked and didn't like? Or
I didn't. My heroes were Cliff Freeman, Meg Elliott, and Mark Fenske. I guess that was my bar for talented people. And I just didn't think the people who were critiquing my ads, going all the way to Charlie Moss, actually, you know, I don't know. I didn't accept their criticism. I guess I was a bit, I argued too much or something. I don't know. I remember with Susan, and we're really good friends now, but when I was working for her, I showed her some scripts for M&Ms, and she liked two out of the four that I showed her. And she's like, let's go to the ECD, Charlie Meesmer, and I want you to show them those ideas. So we went into his office and I read him two scripts and he didn't like either one. And Susan stands up and says, well, that's it. And I said, well, no, that's not it. I have these other two scripts. She looked at me like, you know, you're not supposed to do that. I killed those other two scripts. So I just read the other two scripts and the ECD bought them. And he's like, yeah, we'll do those. We'll present those. And then after a few days went by and he presented them to the client and I sold those two scripts. And he's like, the good news is you're going to go make those two scripts. The bad news is you're kicked out of Susan Cradle's office for like, you know, not listening to her creative direction. So,
well, probably a good result in the end.
It was a good result in the end, yeah. Because I was, again, I was floating and I didn't have a group to be in. That's a dangerous position, you know, for a creative director, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if you know, but because I was floating and I now, you know, the ECD liked me, he came up to me and said, there's an assignment on Snickers. Right. And I want you to work on it. And that was my, you know, my first, you know, campaign that I crafted with my partner, Dave Gray, the guy I met at Saatchi. And, you know, that was 96 or 97, I guess.
Was that the outdoor work?
Well, no, that was later on, actually. This was a campaign called Not Going Anywhere for a while.
So yeah.
People like, I don't know, just stuck in situations where they don't have access to any food. So it was like not going anywhere for a while,
yeah,
grabbing
yeah.
Snickers. And I think Adweek in 96 or 97 named it like Campaign of the Year or something
yeah.
like that. And from that, then things started moving for me. And everybody was calling. Cliff Freeman finally called, you know.
Cliff Freeman called you.
Yeah,
so
not Cliff himself. I think it was David Angelo at Cliff Freeman who called me up.
And what happened there? Because you obviously didn't go there. That was your dream agency.
Yeah, it was my dream agency. I don't know what happened. Well, no, that's not true. I do know what happened. So, you know, Cliff called, Wyden called, which was huge. Fallon called, you know, and I was, you know, I think it was great. And at the time in 96 or 97, I thought Goodby Silverstein was the best agency in the country.
Yeah.
I was just loving their work. And they didn't call. And I remember really being bothered by that. I'm like, if Wyden calls you, right, and Cliff Freeman
yeah.
calls you, like, why aren't you calling me? My partner and I were like, God damn it, what happened? So at the end of the day, I remember calling Jeff Goodby and getting his voicemail and saying, hi, my name's Jerry Graff. I did the Snickers campaign. I love your agency, and I would love to work with you. And within 45 minutes, their recruiter called me up. And what the thing was is BBDO was Omnicom and Goodby was Omnicom. So
right.
Goodby couldn't call me. But since I had called him,
okay.
then it was okay for them to call me back. And Jeff told me he actually needed to, like, save my voicemail to show to John Wren that he wasn't poaching people. So I got a job offer from Cliff Freeman. But they were just looking for a writer. And my partner and I got an offer from Goodby Silverstein. And I just thought, you know, since, you know, my partner and I had done, you know, the best work of my career, that we should stick together. I shouldn't go off by myself, which is why I turned down Cliff Freeman. After telling Cliff Freeman to his face that it was my dream job. So...
And was that the BBDO New York in your first stint? Was that when you did the Red Stripe campaign?
No, that was my second stint.
That was your second
stint.
That
was yeah. So, you know, I just did the Snickers campaign in my first stint, and then went to Goodby for about 3.5 years.
So how was that? Obviously, that's a new part of the country, and presumably a very different kind of setup to anything you'd been in at that point.
Yeah, it was very hard for me. I had never been to San Francisco. I didn't really fit in. There was a lot of pressure. I was amazed by the level of talent at Goodby Silverstein. I remember I went out there first. My wife and I moved out there before my partner moved out there. And I remember calling him up and saying, because at BBDO, everybody had all their awards in their offices, you know,
yeah.
to you know, because I guess they needed proof that they were good. The work wasn't good enough. So, you know, you'd have your, you know, shelf
yeah.
or whatever. And I remember calling my partner up and saying, don't bring your awards to Goodby Silverstein. Everyone has them and nobody displays them.
Right. Interesting.
And... Yeah, which I loved, but I was really intimidated at Goodby, and I had a kind of hard time kind of fitting in.
What made you intimidated? Because obviously, by this point, getting thrown out of various groups, you're obviously quite confident in your opinion, and you'd just done campaign of the year. What was so intimidating about Goodby's at that point?
Well, I guess it was the reason I was confident is because I really didn't have much respect for any of my bosses. I didn't think
right.
they had done, you know, through the, you know, I learned, you know, I was just a cocky little shit as a copywriter. And, but the people I was at bad agencies, you know, I worked for some good people, you know, I learned a massive amount. I learned how to be a writer at Wells with my creative director, Michael Mark. But even then, I really didn't think that my bosses had done any work that I wanted to do or that I respected. So that's where my confidence came from. I'm like, well, I'm not going to really listen to you because you really haven't done anything that I want to do. And then all of a sudden I'm at Goodby Silverstein, where not only have, you know, Rich and Jeff done amazing work their entire career, but every other creative in there had done award-winning work. So I had no reason to be cocky or thinking that I was better than somebody else. And it took a while. It took about a year or two to kind of like fit into the groove at it could be Silverstein. So, but that just made me work harder. Every night up till 11, just pushing the work because it had to be as good as the people around you.
And what were they like to present to, Goodby and Silverstein?
Very different. So you're either a rich guy or a Jeff guy. You know, Jeff ran half the accounts and Rich ran half the accounts. So Jeff would do this thing. He would passively suggest things. He's like, yeah, this is pretty good, but if you want, try it or don't try it, but here's a thought I'd like you to think about, but see where it goes, and if it doesn't go anywhere, that's fine. So then you would try it and you didn't go anywhere, so you did your own stuff, and you'd come in and he would be like, where the hell is the idea I told you to work on? You learn quickly that if you kind of want to maybe try this means do it, so that was kind of Jeff. And being a writer, presenting to Jeff was terrifying because he was like president of the Harvard Lampoon and just like an amazing writer. I remember I would like proofread my emails to Jeff like five times and pull out Strunk and Whites, to make sure like everything was perfect and stuff. Rich, on the other hand, was and is incredibly direct.
This sucks.
I like this part of this thing and do that. And I did most of my work on Rich accounts, just a different style of working.
So what did
Rich,
you?
Rich's fan. I learned one great thing from Rich, and I've kept it with me. If he hated something, but you loved it, right?
Yeah.
And you could show your passion for it, and let him know the thinking behind it, right? But really had some passion for it. Even if he hated, he would let you show it to the client. If you could really prove that, you had passion for it. And I did something for E-Trade, the online brokerage thing, and he hated it. He hated it. He thought it was depressing. And I'm like, no. I used to be a broker. The world is like this, and I loved it. He's like, no, it's a depressing ad. I'm like, no, please let me show you. He's like, fine, you can show it. And I sold it. And I came back. I'm like, hey, we sold it. And he goes, still doesn't make it good just because you sold it. But he let me do it. So we went out and we made it. And I showed it to him. He's like, yeah, I still don't like it. And it ended up winning gold at Cannes. And back in those days, Cannes would actually come to the agency and present have a big presentation with the gold line.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I remember there was this little lunchtime affair, and the agency was out there, and they brought in the gold line and they gave it to me. and Rich came up to me and whispered in my ear, I still think that ad sucks.
It's amazing for someone in his position to sort of go with that attitude. If he doesn't like it, just put that kind of level of faith and trust in you. Hard to do.
Really hard to do, but, probably one of the reasons.
And also put the agency, presumably put some agency money in getting that made, sort of backing you rather than the idea. It's good.
Yeah.
So do you think that's the most competitive creative department you've worked in?
By far.
Is it?
By far. And I brought my own insecurities in there. It turned into like a very, very healthy competition after a while. I'm sorry, just gotta shut this crap off. And there were amazing people there. Paul Venables and Greg Bell went on Venable Bell. Steve Simpson was there.
Yeah.
Just amazing people. And after a while, the intimidation left, and I started using this incredible talent like around me. If my partner and I had an idea, we would run out of the room and try to, if Paul was Venables was there, we're like, hey, look at this. We think it's fantastic. So it turned into a very healthy kind of place after a while.
So what do you think the biggest learning from Goodby Silverstein was that when you'd left, what did you take with you?
I took with me, that lesson from Rich. You know, if you might not as a, like, that was the first time I became a creative director. So, you know, just look for passion in other people. So I took that. Also, Goodby, I think, was one of the first agencies to bring planning into their agency in the United States. And I got to work with John Steele, who's an amazing planner, and I really, learned the value of really good strategic planning to actually help you get to a great idea, and also how to sell a great idea. And that has stuck with me since then. You know, every place I've gone, even when I went back to BBDO, and BBDO at the time really didn't have or respect planning, I found a planner in there to kind of work with. That was a big learning process there. So, I also learned it, being surrounded by all that incredible talent.
Yeah.
I also learned that you still have to do the work. I mean, we were all there just working, very late nights and weekends, with the most talented creatives there. But it wasn't just because I'm talented, the first thing I'm going to write down is going to be great. I also learned that you just have to work and write and write and write and concept and concept and concept and keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And my partner and I developed this really good kind of working relationship where we'd get an idea and he would go, okay, that's a good idea, but we would park it and we go, more, we have to do more, you just have to work and work and work and work and work. So I developed a really good work ethic at Goodby Silverstein.
So what made you leave, Jerry? It sounds San Francisco is my favorite place on earth, probably. Goodby's was one of the best agencies at the time around. Why leave?
Yeah, and I'm winning Lions too. So,
and you're winning Lions.
why leave? My partner and I had a falling out, and really weren't getting along. And I asked for a change, but Jeff and Rich wouldn't change it up, because whether or not we got along with each other, we were still professionals. We could, park our personal feelings for each other aside and really just do good work. And in fact, like, when a team comes in and the art director reads his ideas and the copywriter reads his ideas, when that starts going on, that's what was going on there. So it started getting tough after about three and a half years. So we had one of those, advertising, kind of broken marriages. But even so, like, we really didn't like each other, but we still wrote, amazing stuff together. And that's why Rich and Jeff wouldn't split us apart. And then they were thinking of opening Goodby New York. And I had my first kid, and I really wanted to go back to New York. And they said, if you win another New York account, you can be the creative director of Goodby New York. And I was like, great. And then so I won, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, which was just kind of starting out at the time back in 2000. I'm like, there, did it. They're like, okay, you're gonna be. I still have the contract that says I'm creative director of Goodby New York.
Oh, really?
We flew out to New York, and we kind of started scouting places and stuff. And then I remember that the day I signed my contract as creative director of New York, Sirius XM had fired their entire marketing staff. And at the end of the day, Rich came to me and said, they're pretty much going to let us go because the people who hired us are gone. So we're not doing New York. And I was, I had already moved in my mind. What I mean? And that was heartbreaking. And, so I was like, didn't know what to do. And Ted San had called me up, and, I had left, I guess, almost 4 years ago as like a senior copywriter. They had BBDO had a million titles. I think I was a senior copy manager or something, not quite a creative director.
Okay.
When I left, and he called and he offered me a job as an executive creative director. you know, right, reporting directly to him, the CCO. So, you know, I wasn't getting along with my partner. I thought I was moving to New York, and I was pulled out from under me. And then Ted Sand calls up with a with an amazing offer, and I decided to take it.
And what would that mean? Is that in London there tends to be one ECD? Is that the same in New York?
No, BBDO.
A number of ECDs would work under Ted Sand.
Yeah, they had four ECDs. Then under the ECDs, GCDs, and before the GCDs, the CDs, and a lot. All it meant to me was that there was only one person who could affect my work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
I
moved back down.
How did you adapt to that ECD? Obviously, it's a lot more dealing with non-creative things, I guess.
Yeah, I that was a learning experience, but I had got some good learning on how to be a creative director at Goodby Silverstein. And even though I was an ECD at BBDO, it was me, a freelance writing partner that I had who came in, you know, maybe 6 months during the year, and then two teams below me. So I was, you know, kind of a fringe player. And, right. And I didn't, you know, I've made some mistakes. So like I went back to BBDO and, you know, coming from Goodby, you know, I was still like, BBDO is not Goodby. So I moved my office from the sixth floor, which was the creative floor, up to seven, which I think at the time was the media floor, just to get away from, you know, people I used to have to report to and people who had kicked me out of their group and stuff, and just made an office in the corner of the media department and had my teams up there, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, maybe a little bit of both, tried to separate myself and pretend that I actually wasn't back at BBDO. I had my own thing. And, you know, that wasn't great, but it worked for me because we ended up doing some good work there. That's when I did the Red Stripe stuff and the Guinness stuff.
And that's in... So in 2001, you go back. What month in 2001?
I don't know. Probably August or September.
August. So I'm just thinking, obviously, 9/11. So you were there when 9/11 happened?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I was in, you know, I remember Ted Sand coming up saying I was the new ECD on FedEx, which blew my mind because I was a huge fan of that, you know, Ali Gargano work. And then he also informed me that FedEx is also in review. That's why I'm the ECD.
Right, great.
I'm great, thanks. But, you know, it worked out. I worked with a great account guy, John Osborne, who's now, I think, he's the president or CEO of BBDO North America. And we were a good team. And we with Ted Sand and some other people, we saved the business. So in September of 2001, I'm in Los Angeles getting ready to shoot six FedEx spots. I remember, you know, the morning getting a call from my wife early, like, you know, 5:45 when the first plane hit the tower, and her telling me what was going on. And my wife at the time was 9 months pregnant with our second daughter. And my brother-in-law had flown out from Boston, where one of the planes came out of. On I think it was United, and we weren't sure if he was on the plane that hit. He was not, fortunately, but I remember that morning. That was the morning of our first. We were supposed to be shooting FedEx, and then all the phone lines kind of went down, and no one knew what to do. So we actually went to, you know, I made sure my wife. You know, we live about 5 miles from Wall Street, so I knew she was okay. But we actually went to the shoot. Joe Picca was shooting the campaign, and Steve Carell was one of the actors in it. And we all went to the set, and no one knew what to do. It was a really obviously strange morning. So we all went back to Pitka's production company and just sat around, just trying to get in touch with, you know, with our loved ones and relatives and friends back in New York. And they, you know, it, throughout the day, cell phone service was going way down, you know, just too many people trying to call New York, and it was hard to get in touch with people, and that was terrifying. And then they shut down all, there were no flights to New York anymore, and there weren't going to be flights to New York for a week. So I was stuck in Los Angeles.
Away from your wife.
A wife, a two-year-old, and she's 9 months pregnant. But there was no way to get home. And we all kind of grouped together, the cast, the client, and the agency, and we're like, we're not going anywhere. We're stuck here. And what do you want to do? And we all decided that we were going to shoot the campaign. And we all decided we were gonna work. So the next day, 9/12, we started shooting our TV campaign, and we shot for 3 days. Then after we wrapped on Friday, Ted Phan, you know, who was the CCO, he was out there with us, and he knew the Frito, you know, I think Frito-Lay was one of our clients at DVDO, and they had a private jet in Los Angeles, and Teterboro Airport, which is a private airport right outside of New York, was allowed to open up, and he called me, and he got me, my partner, and actually the Steve Carell and the other actor, on the, and it's kind of funny because they're these, you know, they're private Lear jets, right? But Frito-Lay names their jets. So we flew back home on Friday after 9/11 in the Chester Cheetah, who's the mascot for Cheetos, in the Chester Cheetah jet. On the tail of the plate, on the tail of the plane, painted on there is Chester Cheetah, like hanging on, like
you got it off.
And we flew into New York on Friday night in the Chester Cheetah.
So not long after that, you get Rudy Giuliani gets in touch with put together a marketing team to start getting tourism back to New York.
Yeah, it was less than a month later. A month later to get tourism back, and he told us he wants people to smile and feel good about New York, and it's okay to come back. And he contacted Phil Dusenberry, who you know was the chairman of BBDO at the time, and Phil put a team together, you know, from people, creative directors at BBDO, and incredibly honored that he asked me to join that team. And we contacted some directors like Pitka and Brian Buckley, and within a week, you know, we all just sat in a room and we crafted this campaign using New York celebrities, you know, living out their New York dreams. You know, Woody Allen skating at the rink, and the first one I wrote was Barbara Walters trying out for Broadway. and it was wonderful. And I remember finishing the last spot we were shooting, the end part with Mayor Giuliani, on Halloween on October 31st, and my wife was going in to be what do you call it when they kind of kickstart the pregnancy?
Induced.
Yes, yeah. She was on Halloween night. She was being induced, and I was shooting, and we finished, and I thank Rudy Giuliani, and I said, I'll always remember that because my daughter's going to be born tonight. Or I didn't know it was a daughter at the time. Yeah. My second child's going to be born. And he looks at me, he's like, what? I said, yeah, my wife's going in to be induced. And I remember Rudy Giuliani looking at me going, then what the hell are you doing here? Kind of set me straight. You know, Rudy Giuliani said I could leave to shoot early. So I left and went to the hospital, and my daughter was born that night.
So were you dealing with Giuliani much on that project?
Yeah, he was involved, you know. So, you know, like I said, we all kind of met as a group and talked about stuff that we wanted, and he would come in, or we would go down to City Hall and show him stuff.
So at the time, he was one of the greatest guys around. He was like calm, civil. He was amazing. Whereas now
he
seems
the greatest guy.
Yeah, now he seems to have turned into a complete Fruit Loop.
I have no idea. And that night, I took a picture shaking Mayor Giuliani's hand, and I had that picture with me for maybe 10 years. And I got rid of it after, you know, after he. I don't know what happened.
He was just so dignified and made you feel great, you know.
He made America feel like it was going to be okay.
We're
going to be safe. We're going to be fine. And maybe he's just one of those guys who is great in a crisis situation. He needs a crisis to do it. I don't know what happened, and I can still feel like throughout the years my love for that guy just diminishing. Going, what is going on? You know.
Weird.
But and he loved great creative. You know what I mean? He loved. That's another reason to love. He went to BBDO because he thought that was the best agency.
Because he liked their work.
And he wanted great work that made people smile even after this tragedy. And he was fantastic.
Well, it must have been nice at that time as well. When, I mean, people forget how scary it was. You know, in the not only 9/11, but the days following, because you didn't know what. But to actually do something about it, to get your pen out and actually help in some way. So it must have felt great.
It's still probably the best moment I've had in advertising, you know. And it was the early days of the year. I remember comments and emails and letters coming in from New Yorkers, like just thanking whoever did this campaign for making me feel better. And that was amazing.
Yeah. So on your second time back, how did you cope with BBDO? I would imagine how many people would be at BBDO at this time? It would be a much, obviously, enormous compared to Good Biz.
Yeah, I think
there were about. I imagine that's tough.
I think there were about maybe 400. You know, maybe more. And Good Biz might have been at the time. Gee, I don't know. Maybe 150 or something like that. I coped with it by removing myself.
You know, right, so onto the separate floor.
That's why I moved on to the separate floor. I actually, you know, had office services make me a sign on my door that said BBDO North.
Okay.
and really just concentrating on pushing through great work, you know, and really. I remember starting to feel confident in my abilities where I really did not care if I got fired because I knew I wouldn't get another good job. So, you know, being pushing hard on the work, creating work that, you know, would scare or make clients nervous, I had no problem doing that because, you know, I find in advertising, on both the client and advertising side, people make decisions and do mediocre work because they're afraid to lose their job. And I just didn't have that, you know. I was really pushing hard on creating, you know, great breakthrough work and really pushing on clients and, you know, just to sell it. And also bringing my newfound love of planning into my little group and using that to sell work. So, it wasn't great working at a place and deciding you kind of didn't want to be there and having to make your own little bubble, but it worked out. We had a wonderful little team up on the seventh floor, and I, you know, did some stuff I was really proud of.
What would have been your favorite pieces of work from that period? There's obviously a lot from that period.
The Red Stripe work that we did, Hooray Beer, which is like probably the best tagline I've ever written, and the way we sold the work, you know, Diageo is a very, you know, has a really set process, and they kind of dictate they have their I don't know, their brand strategy pyramid or something like that. And remember the brand, whatever, that what we were supposed to be working on was Red Stripe brings out your inner you.
Hilarious.
Like every alcohol doesn't do that.
Yeah.
And just saying no, we're not doing that. And creating my partner and I were just like no, it's Jamaican beer, but it's not dreadlocks and beach Jamaica. It's actually from Kingston, and we went and we got the Jimmy Cliff movie. What's it called?
The harder they come.
And watching and getting a feel for kind of Kingston and going, you know, these guys are nice and dangerous at the same time. And we're like, we want that tone. And we're going to have a spokesperson because Red Stripe had this like mayor of beer. It was this guy, this Jamaican man in a tuxedo with a sash. They already had that. Yeah. It was on their website. And we're like, ooh, we're going to use that. We're going to have him. And, you know, he's going to be this nice, you know, funny kind of guy, but he's going to get angry every once in a while. So we decided that's what kind of Kingston was the kind of edge. And we decided that the brewers of Red Stripe weren't trying to, it's not a great beer, right? But it didn't matter to them because at least they made beer, right?
Yeah.
And they were just happy they made beer. So that's where Hooray Beer came from. That was the end line. We made beer.
I mean, I love the Red Stripe stuff. It's such a sort of, I think sometimes creatives try and be too clever, and it's so visceral and basic. Boo something, hooray beer, as a little structure is just almost, it's hard to write something so basic as that and make it work. How on earth did you sell that to Diageo? I've worked with Diageo. I just can't imagine how you go about getting them to say, boo, sand in your shorts, hooray, beer.
Yeah, the first thing we kind of did was take them through our thought process, you know, of how we kind of came up with it and the whole Kingston thing. I remember walking into our first creative presentation with a six-pack of Bud Light, who was doing all those kind of frat boy ads, you know. And just putting the six pack of Bud Light on the table and saying, we are not them. We are the opposite of Bud Light, this corporate frat boy kind of beer. They kind of liked that. And then even after that, we showed them a bunch of stuff. And the first round was not the boo stuff. It was it comes in a short and stubby bottle, and there's nothing wrong with being short and stubby. And we had the little guy who was like,
short, stubby guy, yeah.
Yeah, I'll drink to that. But they're like, but this is not Red Stripe brings out your inner you. We're like, no, we don't want to do that. The cool thing about Red Stripe at the time, it was a small brand, right? I was also working on Guinness, which was tougher because you had global brand managers looking at that work. We had this one great client, Chris Parsons at Diageo, who was kind of working on his own and no one was looking at Red Stripe. So he actually, out of like six spots that we presented, he picked the two that were closest to brings out your inner you. And we went, I was working on it with, he's a director now, Harold Einstein, he was my writing partner at the time. Go out to LA and, we picked a director who needed stuff that was real, Marco Siega. He was doing music videos at the time. For like the Offspring and stuff like that, and he wanted to get into commercials, so we got him to do it. And we were shooting in locations in Los Angeles, and we found a way to shoot the two spots that the client approved, and then we needed a lot of extras for those spots, so we actually cast the extras to be able to perform the other spots that we wanted to shoot.
Cool.
So we shot the two. They were rather simple shoots. We shot the two the client wanted, and we made sure he was happy. You know, we'd done it in like half the time. And we're like, do we have everything you want? He's like, yeah. I'm like, you sure? We'll get anything else you want. He's like, no, I love it. I think he nailed those two spots. And then we said, okay, is it all right if we shoot some other spots? And he's like, yeah. And then we brought the extras over, and they were actually, we had cast them to shoot the other thing. And he kind of laughed. He's like, I was wondering why there was a 4'10", you know, extra in the cast. And we shot the other stuff. And we ended up running the stuff we wanted to shoot, really not running the stuff we went out there to shoot. And that was a lesson. My partner, Harold Einstein, you know, he kind of came up with the plan on how to do it and sit with the director and make sure we can get that and work with the production company, see if they were okay to do that and really get what we want with at the same time giving the client what they wanted and not pissing them off, right? Really, just doing everything we could to get what we thought was right. And at the end of it, it turned out that, yeah, we were right. And then, you know, Red Stripe, you know, was this tiny little brand that nobody was looking at, and they just, you know, the cases started. The campaign really, they sold a ton of beer.
So it's interesting. So that even those commercials that are very funny have come out of a sort of truth, which is let's not overclaim, you know, let's be quite Jamaican. You know, it's come out of truth rather than comedy has been overlaid on the top. But there's a sort of fundamental truth. Is that the planning element that you got from Good Biz, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. And I've kept that with me. And I tell all my clients, you know, I'm going to present you stuff. And you might think I'm just being creative because I want to be, or crazy or stuff like that. But I can actually go back to planning and give you a strategic reason why we're making these creative decisions. And it's allowed me to sell, you know, some good work.
So about 3 years later, I think, you go to TBWA.
Yep.
Again, that's another quick move. You don't hang around at these places, do you?
Yeah, I do. I'm glad. You know, my agency is about 7 years old. So
is that the longest you've been?
Exactly, yeah.
So why move to TBWA? The hard cash or just...
No, it was actually... They paid me less than BBDO or at the time. It was not a money thing. It was my first chance to run an entire creative department.
Yeah.
At Shia New York, there was only one ECD, you know, and I ran the New York, or was offered to run the New York creative department and report to Lee Clow. Not wanting a title, but wanting what that title means, which is no one can really, you know, screw with my work except for one person, and that's Lee Clow. And you know, if anybody can screw with your work, why not, you know?
And how did you find that, running effectively an agency?
Again, you know, this is a recurring theme that has kind of just come. I've never really thought of it. I had a hard time at Shia New York. I did not know how to run an entire agency. I learned very quickly that, you know, I think when people become creative directors, their urge is to still be the writer or art director or the creative person on the assignments, you know, and try to, you know, I didn't have that ability that Rich did to say, I trust you, go off and do it. So, you know, you kind of, even then as ECD, there's more and more, you know, you're trying to work on everything. And I was almost losing my mind, but then I just kind of figured out, I'm like, okay, like Shia New York was not Shia at LA. Shia New York pretty much had the clients that Lee didn't want to work on.
Right.
The money making clients, they just give them what they want kind of clients. And it was a very account run agency. And I wasn't getting a lot of support there. In fact, I was kind of fired and let go about 11 months in to my time there. The president at the time and John Hunt, who was global chairman or something, sat me down and said it wasn't working. it was kind of weird, and I kind of talked myself out of getting fired. That was a big blow.
Right.
And getting, you know, kind of one more chance, because I had come in there, you know, I'd gone to Goodby, and every assignment you push the work. I went to BBDO, and I had my own little group where we would kind of consistently push the work. And I go to Shy at New York thinking it's Shy at LA, and I'm really pushing the work, and we're losing accounts, and we're not winning business, you know. People coming, you know, clients coming to New York, like healthcare and stuff like that, and I'm trying to show ultra creative stuff for, you know, diabetes medicine, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
You can do some funny stuff on diabetes medicine.
Yeah, well, you should, actually. But anyway, it was a mess. It was a mess. And so, like, I was almost fired. And then our president was indicted by the federal government. They had worked at Ogilvy before, and there was this problem with, like, doctoring the timesheets on government accounts and putting too many hours in. So we're all, and then Shiat stood behind this person and wouldn't let them go. So we're at an agency where we're not going to win business at all. And it kind of got messy. But I got lucky because we had a small account from M&M Mars, this small chocolate bar. And through that relationship with Mars and my former, you know, I had done the Snickers campaign for M&M Mars. We got to work on Skittles.
So what was the thinking there with Skittles, the planning? Because I remember, it's funny, I have this bugbear with a lot of funny ads, that they're not actually funny. And when you're around them and you go to the recording studios, everyone's laughing, and then they go on air and they're not as funny as the programs. Whereas the Skittles ads, I remember showing them to my kids because they were just, I mean, they were like Monty Python. They were like genuinely joyful, funny, bizarre things. What was the planning there?
Well, the planning was, Skittles had been doing the same campaign for 15 years. So Merlin goes out to the pier, you know, some wizard, and opens up a pack of Skittles and throws it into the ocean, and then the clouds come and start raining Skittles, right? Or,
yep.
You know, or there's a unicorn, and it was basically the same thing. Something magical happened, and then a little girl said, "Taste the rainbow." And that worked for 14 years, but in the 15th year, sales started, you know, going down. So the whole campaign came from planning. So the first thing we said was, you're talking to 14-year-olds, okay? And you're doing a campaign from 1990, and it is now 2004, 2005. A 14-year-old in 2004 is completely different than a 14-year-old
yep.
from 1990, because something happened kind of called the Internet. And a 14-year-old nowadays is basically like a 19, 20-year-old from 1990. So they're just exposed to just so much more, and they have a different mindset. So that's the first thing we told them. The second thing is, like, you know, you look at what your, I guess you'd call it brand equity. What do you as a brand own that people identify with you? And it's the rainbow, that tagline, and magic, right?
Yeah.
And we're like, you own magic because you've just been doing it for 15 years. No other brand is this magical brand. But again, from 1990, you were doing kind of Disney magic, and magic has changed. And we showed them the remember the Fatboy Slim video where Chris Walken is flying
yeah, yeah.
in the hotel?
Yeah.
Showed them that. Showed them a Beck video where he's walking down the street holding an entire car to his ear like it's a boombox
yeah.
or something. We're like this is magic now, and you know, when you're talking about magic, basically that means anything can happen, and they were kind of on board with us. Actually, it was hard to sell it. I remember to prove our point, our planning department and our account person made like a 3-minute rip of that Chris Walken video and back in a bunch of propeller head stuff and,
yeah.
and just stuff that was happening in videos. And, you know, put it on a laptop, went to a mall in the middle of the country in Cincinnati, Ohio, and just showed it to teenagers, right?
Yeah.
And said, do you like this kind of stuff? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, do you like Skittles? And they were like, yeah, we were filming this. And they're like, do you think Skittles could do this type of stuff? And they all said, yeah, it's magic. Skittles is magic. So
yeah, brilliant.
That's how we proved to the client that we were right, you know? So that's, it started there. And then we knew we were going to keep the rainbow. But our strategist said, you know, when we talk to kids about Skittles, they play with them, they separate them by color. You can actually smell the fruit flavor off of them. So there's more to enjoy than just the taste of a Skittle. So we combined the whole magic thing where anything could happen with this kind of campaign thought called, I guess, blank the rainbow or experience the rainbow.
Yeah.
So we changed it into, you know, see the rainbow, taste the rainbow, believe the rainbow, taste the rainbow. And again, you know, all from strategic thinking. And they bought it. And then we, you know, two incredible creative directors working under me, Scott Patron and Ian Reichenthal, and they were working with a junior team, Craig Allen and Eric Kalman, who
yeah.
went on to do Old Spice, right?
Yeah.
So not a bad team, right?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. And they were actually, they were, my generation is Monty Python, their generation is Tim and Eric.
Right.
In Wonder Shows and in stuff like that, stuff that was happening on Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network and stuff. So that, I think Tim and Eric influenced Skittles more than anything else. And then we kind of, you know, actually set up some rules. So, like, Skittles magic always it always happened in real life kind of boring situations, like a job interview,
yeah.
a guy in the back room of a video store. And there was always one element of magic that happened. And in that world, because we did want to create the Skittles world, nobody was thrown by the magic. If you go
right.
back and watch
yeah, yeah.
the first 10 or 20 spots, it's a given. That piece of magic kind of, and that was thought out by us, really for a creative point, you know, but we just liked it that way.
So was that just to give yourself some rules for... Is that a strategy, or is that because otherwise you've got it's so open that you don't know where to begin? Or is to, I guess that's to hold them together, is it?
Creatively, it was funnier when people were not amazed by the bit of magic, and it was also we also did it really to have kind of guidelines because otherwise you could just be all over the place.
Yeah.
You know.
So those early ones would have been Sheep Boys and things like that.
Yeah, Sheep Boys. There was the teenagers actually sitting on a rainbow, and one of the guys doesn't believe in the rainbow, so the rainbow opens up and drops in 2,000 feet to the
yeah.
earth. It was that one. Yeah, so all of those ones.
And then presumably because of the success of that, then you started getting other briefs like Starburst and...
Yeah, we started selling a lot of Skittles. So
yeah.
then we got Starburst, and then we got to pitch Snickers, and nicked it from BBDO, and that's where we did the out of home stuff for Snickers with the kind of made up words.
Hungerectomy and
yeah. And then there was strategy behind it just looks like silly words, but our strategy for that was Snickers is the number one candy in America, and your advertising doesn't kind of show that. It seems a little safe. So we think you are so famous that you're an icon that you don't even need to put the word Snickers on a Snickers ad. Because none of the out-of-home had said Snickers. We just took the packaging kind of iconography and took words that related to it, you know, like hunger and satisfying and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Just made up, you know, it's a bit like Jabberwocky, right? We just made up words, and we said, and people will know that those are Snickers ads, and it doesn't even say Snickers, and that will kind of cement your icon status in people's minds, and that's you know, that's what happened.
Yeah, it's a good... It's because it, on the face of it, it looks very brave, even though on the one hand it's an enormous logo, but it doesn't mention them at all. But going in with that sales pitch sounds persuasive.
Yeah.
It's good. So, next, this can't be right. Let me go back to my notes because... So next, and I don't know whether this is some fake news that you've put out. It says switch to a company called Driver Digital.
Yeah.
So what was...
No,
what was
next was Saatchi & Saatchi.
Okay, sorry, Saatchi & Saatchi, and then, yeah. So again, you've done your 3 years.
Yeah.
Your traditional 3-year stint. The time's up, and you have to find somewhere new to go to. So Saatchi & Saatchi, New York, again. So what a change. Why go there, and what a change since you went there last?
Well, I was going at the end of Shiat. With Skittles and Starburst and some Sprint work, we were, I think we were named, Shiat New York was named most creatively awarded agency in the world.
Yeah.
I never leave a place without some success. And, I remember in the early days of Shiat, we were having a hard time, and I got the creative department together, and I said, you know, when I'm successful, I have an enemy, and I need to, you know, have a goal to take somebody down, and I'm going to tell you guys who our enemy is, and I wrote Shiat LA.
Right? Yeah.
I said, they're our enemy. We're going to destroy them. I'm sick of hearing of all the Apple work.
Yeah.
We're going to bury them. And I remember getting a call from Lee Cloud that he heard what I had said, and I was honestly nervous for a while, and he thought it was the greatest thing he'd ever heard.
Oh, really?
He's like, take us down. Yeah, it was fantastic. He's like, take us down, you know? And in that year, you know, with all the Mars stuff, we did. He called me up and he said, congratulations. So that's when my relationships with him, you know, really started working.
So did you work with Lee much?
He would come in a couple of times a year. Sprint was a massive client, and he would come in and look at work. He left me alone on Mars, but on Sprint and Absolute, I worked with him.
Yeah.
And I remember in my early days at Shiat, he would come in and, you know, he looks like a nice kind of surfer Santa kind of laid back guy, but he's not. He's the meanest bastard I've ever worked with.
Oh, really? He looks so gentle and avuncular.
I know he does. It's just not true. And he is brutal. And when he hates work, he hates it. And he would come in, and I'd have all the work pinned up, and he would just rip almost all of it down. Just no, 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 no. And then after about a year of putting up with that, he would come in, and he would do the same thing and rip work down and throw it on the floor. And I would walk behind him and put the ones I still liked back on the board. So we started getting kind of a good relationship going. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot from Lee. And we're still in touch.
Oh, I didn't realize he was such a mean guy. It's funny, I had a weird confession with Lee, which is I think I designed the 2004 DNAD annual, which was all record-based covers, and I gave lots of people the brief to do the page dividers or the jury dividers like an album cover, gave them the pictures, and one of the people I asked was Lee. I found about 42 different people and I never got anything back, and so I spoke to someone else and they did the one that he was supposed to do. I think it was product design, and the book went to print, and about a month later he sent in his finished artwork, which was much better than the one that was used. It was basically based on the White Album product design, and it was a spoof of that. It was great, but it was like he'd not contacted me, and I thought, well, he's obviously just a very laid-back guy, and I don't know. So it's interesting hearing he's not quite as laid-back as I thought. But, yeah, it just turned up a month later.
You know, his nickname, my head account person told me that Lee's nickname for me when he was referred to me in conversation was the petulant child.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
So you were also, when you were at TBWA, you were the most creatively awarded creative director in the world.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. That was nice. And, nice. We never thought of awards when we were creating work. We were just doing it the best work we could for a client. And I was actually surprised when, like, I guess one of the first shows was, like, I don't know, the one show or something, and we won maybe 15 or something. And I was surprised. I'm like, wow, I didn't expect that. Because I've been at other places that the strategy, you know, number one is win an award, right? Yeah. Write award-winning stuff, and then hopefully
never
works. For a client.
Yeah.
It never works. Yeah. So I'm at a high, and that's 2007 when I'm thinking, I almost, you know, got fired. I was losing my mind trying to run every single account, and I decided, you know, to identify the creative opportunities and kind of focus on that and let the other people kind of run their other accounts. And when I got, like, Mars up and running, I moved over to Sprint and kind of got that going. Then I moved over to Absolute. And, again, it was an account-run place. And I picked my team. I picked the account people that I liked. I picked the planners that I liked working for. So, like, out of maybe 250 people, I had a core group of, like, 20 people.
Yeah.
And we ended up, you know, doing award-winning work, selling tons of product for our clients. And that's when I started thinking, I'm like, wow, I put this group together, not just the creative department. I put the account person and the planner and the producer all together. So I could probably put an agency together. And in 2007, I was going to do it with the person who was the managing director of Shy in New York at the time. I had a good relationship with him.
Yeah.
And we you know, had our name for the agency. We had the LLC partnership was all paid for. And he was going to quit first, and then I was going to quit, and we were going to start an agency. And he quit first, and then he came back at the end of the day and said he's going to take the counteroffer. And I'm like,
oh,
okay.
Really?
Yeah, I'm like, good thing you quit first, right? so it was kind of like the Goodby thing where I was already gone, you know?
Yeah.
And then in 2007, even though I was a broker, I'm not an economist, but you could kind of, you know, like 6 months after my idea to start an agency kind of fell apart, I was still at Shiat, but I kind of wanted to leave. I kind of checked out. And you could tell something bad was going to happen in the economy.
Right.
And I was trying to think of what I was going to do. I had actually talked to RGA, not working with them, but I asked them if I could just get a desk in their office and just hang out there and maybe freelance or stuff. I kind of really wanted to jump deep, not into just digital. We had been doing a lot of digital at Shiat, but really get into the mobile space. And I just wanted to go sit in that department. And,
right.
And then, again, these, like, crazy economic indicators are plummeting and stuff. And I'm like, God, maybe I should, like, have something secure. And at that time, Bob Isherwood from Saatchi called me up and wanted me to – Tony Granger was leaving Saatchi and he wanted me to come back. And I politely thanked him and turned him down. And he called me three times, and he's like, let me take you out to lunch. And we went out to lunch. He's a very energetic, persuasive person. And I decided to, I don't know, instead of roaming around freelancing in a kind of scary economy, I would just go and go to Saatchi. But in the back of my mind, wanting to start an agency, but I knew it wasn't cool to take a CCO job and have only one foot in the door.
Sure.
So I told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to take the Saatchi job. We'll kind of be secure. And I'm going to not think about anything else except Saatchi for two straight years, because it wouldn't be fair to bring people in and build a creative department and build an agency thinking of leaving. So, and I said, at the end of those 2 years, if Saatchi lets me do what they're promising, then that Saatchi will be a great place, and maybe we'll just stay there. And I said, if not, I'm going to take and Saatchi at the time was offering kind of crazy money at the time. So, you know, I'll take the crazy money and we'll save it for 2 years and maybe start an agency. And that's what I did. You know,
So were they in the same building that you started off in?
Yeah, same floor.
Once again,
I went back. You know?
Hail the conquering hero. You go back as the young snotty-nosed kid with one ad in his book to emperor.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So that must have felt good.
It did. It felt really good.
Were there any remnants of when you were there before? Any people, sense
David
of it? Or
Perry.
Did it all feel...
David Perry was there, the head of production, and he had been there when I was just some kind of snotty nosed junior, and actually their creative department manager Paul Schulman had been, I think he was like head of production at Wells Rich Green when I was also a junior,
right?
And we. You know, we eventually had a wonderful relationship, but it was kind of weird him reporting to me when, you know, years ago, you know, he's, you know, running a department and I'm a copywriter. But I ended up having a wonderful relationship with him. And then I started, you know, Tony Granger had started off doing great work for Tide and JCPenney. So, you know, Saatchi was a different place than when I was there, you know. And... started off okay, and then, you know, then the recession came. And, you know, when your stock goes from 85 to 4, you're really not in the mood. To take creative risks and stuff like that. But I kind of just, you know, had an amazing, amazing creative department. Probably because of work I did at Goodby and the huge year I had at Shiat with all the Mars work, I attracted some fantastic talent.
So you hired a lot there?
I did. I hired, Chris Beresford Hill, who's an ECD at BBDO, and his partner Nick Spar, he came in. I hired one thing I learned from Shiat New York, John Hunt, when they didn't have any money, they hired 12 juniors right out of school and just have the young people in there. So I did that.
And what would you look for as of those very young people with not much experience?
You're just looking for raw ideas. And what I would let, you know, the entire kind of all the creative directors kind of, you know, talk about the books, and the same books kind of rose to the pile. And then actually what I look for is people who are creative in a different way than I'm creative. You know, I can do my kind of thing, and I might need one other person who does more of the writer kind of sarcastic way, you know, but then I would look for, you know, just like people who would solve problems with beautiful design or technology.
Yeah. So like a range of tools.
Yeah. And no matter what their specific skill was, you know, when you look at an ad, you can basically figure out how the person got there, you know?
Yeah.
And the people I get excited about is when I have no clue of the path from, you know, the brief to the execution. Like, how did you get there? I love those people. So we built a really great creative department in the middle of the, you know, the worst recession in American history, pretty much.
Well, you still got some very good work, Crest and Miller Life, amongst others.
We did. You know, P&G had just, you know, I just started doing Old Spice, but I learned something really important at Saatchi. Having worked previously at Saatchi on Procter & Gamble and then working on Procter & Gamble when I came back, it was a different company with a different mindset. And also General Mills, which is a massive, you know, they make, you know, Cheerios and all the famous American cereals and snacks and frozen food and everything like that. They were a very conservative company when I was there the first time. And these two massive marketers had really discovered that in 2008, you know, no one had to watch your ads anymore. No one had to watch. They had to want to watch your ads. So I really, you know, started, you know, thinking about those two huge companies. I'm like, the value of creativity is the highest it's ever been since I've been in advertising. You have to be creative. You have to do stuff that people seek out, people talk about, and people share.
And P&G understood that at the time.
They did. Yeah. They did. Not on all accounts, you know. It's a massive company, and change is slow. But on some accounts, they were getting some big successes, not just on Old Spice, but on some other stuff. And General Mills understood it too. And I remember talking to a top brand manager at General Mills, saying that he was going to start giving assignments out to smaller creative boutiques. You know, first of all, they were probably cheaper, but also like they were really looking for creative ideas. And that's when I started thinking, like, I could be a creative boutique. And I could get a General Mills crumb, and that's those are good crumbs to get.
Yeah.
I started thinking that. So, you know, at the end,
whoops. Hello.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
It happened with my phone. You know, we did some great work, and the Miller 1 second ad, you know, for Highlight, that was fantastic. And General Mills, I remember, you know, working on their fruit snacks, and you always want to work on like teen stuff because you can get away with more. You can do stuff, and you can just say to the 30-year-old client, oh, you just don't get it, you know.
Yeah.
So I concentrated on that. We did some wonderful work there. JCPenney, we ended up doing some wonderful online videos for them, and but it was getting hard. I mean the recession was really kicking in, and even though we did some good stuff here and there, my 2 years came up, and on that day, you know, I had a discussion with my wife, and I'm like, maybe I'll stay, maybe I won't, I don't know. And she said to me, she's like, listen, you fulfilled whatever contract you made with yourself. You went and you did some good work, and we've got a lot of, you know, decent money stashed away. And she said, you've been talking about your own agency for a long time, and you're going to be impossible to live with if you turn 50 and you haven't tried it. And now's the time to try. So my wife really is the one who finally got me, you know, off my ass. And I decided I was going to do it. So after that decision, the first thing I did was I started having lunch with the Saatchi CFO,
right?
Because I had no idea how to charge for stuff, and I actually got he showed me kind of the books, and he mistakenly, I think, showed me how much Saatchi was making off of me, which was a lot more than I was being paid.
So.
And,
what, they
I'm like,
they were billing your hours out more than you were getting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, wow, maybe I should be making that amount, not what you're paying me. So that kind of got me going. So and then I was friends with Mark, or I still am friends with Mark Waits from Mother. And every time he'd come into New York, I'd go to lunch with him or something. He would always say, you should start your own agency, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. And then actually at the one show that you and I judged, that's where I met David Droga. We kind of became friends, and you know, I went out with him, and he's like, he said the same thing without me even bringing it up. He's like, you should start your own agency. I'm like, wow, these guys kind of know what they're doing, kind of give me some confidence. And I was still kind of nervous about it, and I had heard that Goodby Silverstein was again thinking of opening in New York. So you know, I have a habit of going back to places. So there was this 4A advertising conference in San Francisco. So I told Saatchi I wanted to go to this 4A in San Francisco, which I did. But while I was there, I was going to drop by Goodby Silverstein and see if they wanted me to open Goodby for them. I was still kind of nervous about doing my own thing. I was looking for the kind of safe, easy way out. And I went to Goodby Silverstein, and neither Jeff or Rich were there. I'm like, oh, well. And I'm walking up California Street, and Jeff had just parked in the parking lot, and he's walking down. And I see him. He's like, hey, good to see you. I'm like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And before I could say anything, Jeff says, he's like, you know, I've been thinking about you. I'm like, yeah? He goes, you should start your own agency. And I'm like, okay. I had to fly across the country, you know, but I'll do it. So I have, you know, David Droga, Mark Waits, and Jeff Goodby saying I can do it. So
it's a good game.
Which is weird because, like, throughout my career, I had this weird confidence, you know, and in doing this thing, I needed, you know, the blessings of other people. So I just quit with no clients. I took my assistant from Saatchi with me, and the two of us were in a back room at a friend's production company in Soho down in New York, and I just started making cold calls, really.
And that's straight from Saatchi. Where does this Driver Digital fit in?
So, like, I didn't officially have an agency when I had left Saatchi. I had a desk in a back room in a friend's company, and I didn't have any clients, and I wasn't doing anything. And a friend of mine had a digital production company, and he had asked me to help him develop a comedy website, right. start producing like kind of, you know, quickly, cheaply made content. So I would say the first 8 months when I was freelancing a bit and trying to get clients for my agency, I was also working as, I guess, a producer for Driver Digital, kind of working with the web developers and UX people and developing the website, and I was producing, kind of content. It was actually a lot of fun. I had this wonderful YouTube series called Bug Executions, where we would kill insects using historical execution methods.
Right.
So I crucified a cockroach, and I built a mini guillotine, and we cut the head off of a June bug. And I thought it was funny. I thought it was hysterical. But I got a call from Craig Allen, you know, who was at Wyden doing Old Spice, and he had worked on Scouts for me. He's like, dude, are you okay? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what is this bug execution thing you're doing? I'm like, you don't think it's funny? He's like, no, it's really disturbing. I'm like, oh, okay, whatever. And I did some other, kind of content stuff, content series for this short-lived comedy website called Wholesome Lane. And I still like the tagline, neither wholesome nor a lane. So,
so what was the plan for starting an agency? Obviously, initially, Barton F. Graf 9000. I think you dropped the 9000, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. So I called my mom, and she had been to the Saatchi office, and she saw my corner office with all the glass looking onto the Hudson River, and she was so proud of me and stuff. And then, like, 6 months later, I call her up. I'm like, hey, I quit. And she's like, what? And she's from kind of north of Boston and, you know, seven brothers and sisters and didn't grow up with a lot of money. And so she's not really into risk. And she said this, I want you to go talk to Mr. Saatchi and tell him you made a mistake and ask for your job back. And I'm like, gee, thanks for the vote of confidence, Mom. And then she told me a story of my dad who had passed away years before. My dad was a semiconductor salesman, computer chips and stuff. And she said, you know, your dad had thought about opening up his own sales firm, and he never did it. And then he got sick and he passed away, and it never happened. And I never heard that story before. So I'm like, okay. I didn't want to name the agency Jerry Graf and Partners. I thought that was, I don't know. I just didn't want to do it. So I named the agency after my dad, Barton F. Graf, and kind of gave him the company that he wanted.
Cool.
And then I noticed that my dad had really cool initials, BFG. And I play a lot of video games, and back in the 90s, the big one was Doom, D-O-O-M. And the best gun, the best weapon you could find in Doom was the BFG 9000, the big fucking gun.
Right.
So that was my plan. You know, the full name, Barton F. Graf 9000 LLC, and I wanted it to eventually be shortened to BFG 9000. And I actually had a oil painting commissioned of my dad holding the BFG 9000 gun, which still hangs in the agency. And so that was the plan. My old partner, My old partner, Harold Einstein, thought it was the dumbest name for an agency. And then I remember calling the CEO of Mars to see if I can get any work there. He's like, what's the name of your agency? And I said, BFG 9000. He goes, oh, Big Fucking Gun? I'm like, yeah, yeah. So I called my old partner, Harold, back. And I said, the CEO of Eminem Mars likes my name. All right. So I think I'm doing all right. So I really wanted it to be BFG 9000. And then a year into it, or maybe a year and a half, I had picked up kayak.com as my first client, and then we picked up Little Caesars, which was awesome because
amazing,
that
man.
That was a thing that you loved, straight off, in another cyclical. Yeah, exactly, right? That was a fantastic day. And then we started getting, making some great work and getting a lot of press. And there's a small agency in, North Carolina called the Beverage and Food Group. That's the name of, that's an ad agency, the Beverage and Food Group.
Okay, that sounds good.
And I got a call from my doorman to come down to the lobby one Friday night, and there's this guy, and he hands me these papers. He said, you've been served by the Beverage and Food Group. So the Beverage and Food Group was suing me.
Because you've got the same initials.
Because we have the same initials, and they say they own BFG.com.
Oh, my God.
They were getting all these new business calls, and they found out that they weren't who they thought they were calling me, but they were calling them. So they sued me. And my lawyer said I could win the case, but it would cost about $300,000. And are those initials worth $300,000? No. So we dropped the 9,000, went to Barton F. Graf, and I think people kind of like shorthanded as Barton now.
It's interesting that the initial name, when I first heard it, I thought it was based on Barton Fink, because that's the only time I've heard of Barton. And secondly, having a random number in it, like 9,000, seemed like a positioning idea, because Barton F. Graf 9,000 is not like other. It says straight away, this isn't like the other agencies, I think, by putting the numbers in it. It's a big, clear signal.
I did that. The traditional name with something that throws it kind of off a little bit. I kind of did that on purpose. And I really love the oil painting in our agency. It's a traditional oil painting of the CEO founder holding a giant laser gun. I really like that juxtaposition. And then, to be honest with you, Mark Waits's agency was named Mother, so I named it after my dad.
Yeah.
And Droga 5 had a number
it's the brothers,
at the end
isn't
of his.
Yeah,
yeah, but he had Droga 5, so he had a number at the end, and I thought that was cool too. So I kind of took the mother-father thing and the number thing and kind of put them together.
Well, I think the Droga 5 thing, he's got five brothers, isn't he? Droga 5, which is why it's five.
Yeah,
they're all family-related. Interesting.
Yeah, he's the fifth one. I told David my first thought for a name for the agency was Droga 6, but I thought it would have been confusing. So, and actually, my first thought for the agency before I heard the story about my dad was Graf Zeppelin,
right.
Because I'm a massive Led Zeppelin fan, and there was that blimp, right, the Graf Zeppelin. I thought it just would have been cool, and I could see all the our like logo and stuff. It would have been fantastic. And then somebody told me that what are you going to name the agency? I'm like, Graf Zeppelin. And they're like, the Nazis had one aircraft carrier, and it was named the Graf Zeppelin. I was like, oh, really? And I came home, and my wife's Jewish, and I'm like, can I name the agency after a Nazi aircraft carrier? She's like, probably not. I'm like, okay. I just remember thinking that those damn Nazis, they ruin everything.
Yeah. So what was the plan going in to do things in a different way? I know that when you first started pitching, you were fronting less people than the competitors, and certain things were done differently.
Yeah. The one thought was I had been at big agencies, BBDO and Saatchi and even TBWA. And within that agency, I found that if there was a place with 400 people, like there were actually about 30 people out of the 400, at least the people I thought were talented, that actually did the bulk of the work, not just in creative, but in account services and stuff. And, that was part of our pitch going in. You know, we have, or we're going to have those 30 people. Of course, now we have 70, so I'm fat myself. Yeah. But that was the idea. But that was true. You know, one talented person can really, really do the work of maybe four just average people who just consider their advertising job just a job. Also, you know, I was offered some investment money from a few people, and I didn't think I needed that because, first and foremost, the only thing I didn't need to have account services. All I needed, and I learned this from General Mills and P&G, were fantastic ideas. And I basically needed myself and a few other people and a computer, and we could do that. We could come in with just better ideas. I remember we had about 18 people, and we pitched Dish Satellite TV versus Crispin, and we won. And, you know, it was one reason was probably because we came in cheaper, but I also asked the CEO, why did you choose us? And he looked at me like I was an idiot. He said, you had the best idea. And so I knew going in, if the idea is truly the new currency, you know, throughout, you know, my advertising career, your advertising career, everyone always says that, but that really wasn't the case. But for me, now it really was.
Do you think that's the case, that's it's moved to that place now?
It wavers, but yeah, I do. I think what's changed is I think everyone knows they have to be creative, but now people don't really know what creative means, you know?
Yeah.
I do think it's the case. At least, I mean, for 7 years it's been the case. That's why we succeeded.
Well, it's interesting that I've read that you try and not lean on the creative, but just try and prove that you're smarter in other areas and not just lean on the creative.
Yeah. I do that to sell the work, but also, you know, really taking the time and having smart, strategic thinkers at the beginning of the process, you know, lead you to great ideas I found faster. I'm really proud of the strategy department that I have at Barton.
So, for example, I've read that, here's a direct quote. So, we win business because everyone comes into the room expecting zany, crazy people, and we start off talking strategy for the first hour. And obviously that's working. And when you go through some of the things like Snickers, most people wouldn't think of, obviously you can't see the strategy beforehand. It's only when you talk it through, you think, yeah, that makes total sense. But it's interesting doing it the other way around.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can really see it in new business pitches in our first meetings, like on the client side, on their faces, you know, they're really expecting one thing and then they're like, wow. You know, it's almost like they're looking at a talking monkey or something, you know.
So it's interesting when you say you feel that there's sort of a more appreciation for ideas now, or ideas are further up the agenda. Everyone's always talked about ideas, but there's not much evidence. There didn't used to be much evidence that was the key thing. Whereas creatively, it feels most people do very similar things. A few people try and break out of the norms. You know, most ads now seem to have smiling, happy, semi-good-looking people in. Nobody, it doesn't feel like there's a lot of risks being taken.
Yeah, I mean, we're in this, like most ads are, I don't know, they're based around some noble cause that has nothing really to do with your brand and, you know, very, very heartfelt kind of stuff. It's shifted again, but you know, I don't know. I still find, you know, it's the case that you know, I think a lot of clients, you know, I think one thing that's been going on with Cannes in the past kind of, I don't know,
yeah,
8 years, when clients started flooding into Cannes, I honestly believe clients started flooding into Cannes because they realized they had to be creative and they didn't know what that was. So the clients go to Cannes to see, you know, Cannes has an incredible amount of power right now. And they're kind of dictating what is kind of quote unquote creative for clients. And for whatever reason, Cannes has started awarding that, you know, very heartfelt, cause-related kind of stuff. So that might be one reason we're seeing a lot of that.
Do you think that's the... Is that the... it feels like you're not allowed to now say this product's better because it's got this thing in it. You now have to say we're devoting X percent of the profits to blind kids in Ethiopia, and then you'd build something around that.
Yeah.
But do you think that's to do with the creatives judging it? Because I've been on these awards juries where you can tell that some of the judges want to push something that has a very goody-goody societal message rather than to sell something. Because selling something to some people is inherently grubby. Whereas if you say, that looks like that's going to help that community or that these kind of people, and I want to vote for that.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I think, or part of the reason, I think people get a emotional reaction from some ads, and they think, wow, that ad really touched me, and they're not realizing that it's actually the cause that kind of touched them and not... Or the,
yeah,
the,
nothing to do with the
good,
product,
nothing
the
to
people
do with
who
the
paid.
Product, you know? Yeah, I've never done that. I believe that, you know, I can tell somebody that Little Caesar's pizza is $5 and it tastes really good and do it in a way that's memorable and looked forward to, and it sells a lot of pizza. Yeah.
So I wonder how something like E-Trade would play today in this climate. Do you think it would do just as well, or do you think people would be tweeting about they've wasted all this money and they should have done this with it and they should have done that? You know, it seems a lot
yeah.
more sensitive now. People seem too self-righteous.
People are very self-righteous, but I have had experience, you know, creating stuff that, you know, I guess wasn't PC, and there's big uproars about certain things that I've done, and people are complaining and threatening boycotts to the product. And both times when I've gotten quote unquote into trouble, sales of that product have gone up.
Yeah.
So,
great.
You know,
One thing I was interesting to see, which is that you're a big data fan. So some creatives kind of react against data as if it's either or, but obviously you're sort of using it really well. particularly in the X-Mat stuff,
yeah,
taking the social feeds and stuff. It seems like a really... It feels like, at the moment, what it's like in London anyway, that people... There's a big anti-big data thing, as if that's sort of anti-creative. But I think also Spotify are using it really well, using data.
Really
using,
well, yeah.
Yeah. It seems like a good way forward.
Yeah, I mean, that might go back to my first writing class in Los Angeles at that copywriting workshop. Our writing teacher gave us a copy of Bill Birnbach's speech, I think in like 69, called The Facts Are Not Enough.
Yep.
And, you know, you can't just give people facts. You have to put them together in a new way that feels like a fresh idea. And that always kind of stuck with me. So if you just look at data as facts, you know, it's just stuff that you could take and put them together in a new way that kind of creates an idea. Yeah. I just look at it like that.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's almost like a puzzle, you know? It's like, here's all these pieces and put them together in a way that makes a beautiful portrait. So, and you know, the real-time aspect of it is exciting, and it's just another, you know, just another creative playground, right?
So how do you find it today being a creative compared to when you started? Do you think it's better, worse, same, same old, same old?
I think it's better. You know, it would be nice and I guess easier to have 3 or 4 months to think of something and make a great 60-second film that, you know, runs on TV and stuff like that. But nowadays, there, like I said, there are just more playgrounds for creatives to go in and make stuff. And yeah, you're making stuff faster, and sometimes that takes away from the creative process. But you're making more stuff now. You know, you know, I've done stuff. You know, I've done you know big CGI animated spots for people that were fantastic, and I've gotten assignments on Instagram, assignments in the morning, and had to concept it and have something up by 3 o'clock, and I had just as much fun doing that. I think it's wonderful. I think we, as creative people, you know, more than wanting money, you just want to make stuff. And I've never, you know, like my 20-something career, had more opportunities to just make stuff constantly. And again, sometimes, you know, it takes away from the creative process. But most of the time, it's just like I get to do this, I get to make this, I get to go play over there, I get to go play on, you know, Facebook or Snapchat. I get to do these videos here. There's more places to create. There's faster ways to create. And then I still believe that the value of creativity is higher than it's ever been. So creative people value is more. So, you know, I think it's a wonderful time.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to end on that positive note, Jerry.
All right.
That's amazing. Right. It's amazing. I really appreciate your time. It's a hell of a lot of time. And, yeah, it's brilliant. Brilliant.
I had a wonderful time talking to you.
That's great. Really enjoyed it. I'll start to gather all your work and put it together. And that was fantastic.
If you need me to send any stills or videos or whatever,
I will do. I'll kind of make a list. I've got quite a lot of stuff I've gathered together. Obviously, there's loads on your site. There's lots of quite pixelated red stripe ads out there. There's various things. I'll try and get them together and ping you something.
Yeah.
But that was, I really appreciate your time. I know you're busy and you're probably dying to get to work. If you ever come to London, I'll take you to Arsenal. I'm a season ticket holder, so
I will look you up.
Definitely. All right. Brilliant. Thanks again. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Jerry.
Bye.